Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Welcome inside. A happy Thursday to you. Thanks for checking out the big show in the morning. Getting you ready for your weekend. We're only a day away from that. Love that. My name is Matt Rose. We got Alex Brody running the board today, and very happy that my friend and yours, Nick Alberga, is back on the show. I wanted to do this thing moving forward where on Thursdays or on Mondays, I was going to try and get a beat reporter from each of the teams involved, but it was very difficult trying to track down someone who covers the LA Rams on the beat. So we're going to talk
time out there, man.
Yeah, they're kind of a big deal. That's what we learned. So we're not going to have anybody from the Rams specifically, but Cabby's going to join us a little bit later to talk a little bit of best bets for week one. Still some kind of season futures, as you can hop on some of that type of stuff. That'll be to start hour number three just after 8 o'clock. And then Steve Tasker, who covers the Bills and is the father of Luke Tasker, Canadian who was a tight end in the NFL for a long time with Seattle. He's going to join us at 8:15. He covers the Bills, and we're going to chat a little bit of Bills. Plus, we got so much more to get into, Nick. We had another signing in the NHL yesterday. Ian Mendez from The Athletic in Ottawa is going to join us to discuss the new contract for Timmy Stützle. And Tim Leeper is going to join us as well to go over the series that was for the Baltimore Orioles. So really, all sorts of directions that we could go, and we're going to dive into all three of these things in the morning report. But I guess just a thought, Nick, yesterday, had Tim Stützle sign. What did you think of the contract when it came down?
Yeah, I didn't have an issue with it. I, for one, am massive on Tim Stützle. I think he's going to have a monster season, and I think they paid him as the best player on this Ottawa team, and I think he's going to be the best player one day on this Ottawa team. Now, my eyebrows are raised a bit, and as we all know, they're quite bushy, being Italian and all, a very Peter Gallagher-esque, but they paid him, I believe, just a smidget over what, Brady Tkachuk got, which I think is fascinating because Brady Tkachuk made so much about his contract. I wonder how he feels about his buddy making more than him. And you laugh out there, but it is a thing in NHL dressing rooms. It's a thing in professional sports in general. So I wonder what type of impact that has. But I don't know about you. It's weird to me to see the Ottawa Senators spending to the cap. Last I looked today, they're $7 million off, but they still have Alex Formanton to pay here. So it's a different time. We'll see in the long run what it means for the Ottawa Senators. I think they're much improved, but they're in a really, really difficult division, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I do feel like this is a team that's still a year or two away, but you look at the additions that they made. You bring in DeBrincat, you bring in Giroux. Basically, your top six is set with how well that Norris and Tkachuk and Batherson were able to play together as a trio when all three of them were healthy last season. So basically, you airdrop in DeBrincat and Giroux. And I'm probably being a little bit too simple with all of this, but that's kind of how it looks from the outside. You drop them in to play on the wings with Timmy Stützle, and all of a sudden you've got a great veteran in Claude Giroux to kind of lead the way, and then you've also got a great finisher in DeBrincat, who has shown that, you know, he's a competitive player, and he's a guy that can put the puck in the back of the net, which... that's a bingo if you're Timmy Stützle, for sure. And I've got some questions about the blue line and Cam Talbot and all that type of stuff. But for them to have this core and to have them all locked in at some pretty reasonable numbers, like Batherson's coming in at less than five. And you mentioned the number for Stützle. It's, you know, $100,000 more than Brady Tkachuk. It's not like it's millions of dollars. It's a about $300,000 more than Josh Norris is going to make for the rest of his contract. So it kind of fits right in with the numbers that we're thinking about. And you're getting a guy who's 20 years old, not even going to sign a bridge deal or anything like that. He's entering the last year of his ELC, and here's the bag, dude. So it's pretty wild.
It is wild, and Thomas Chabot got that 8x8 deal a couple years ago, too. And I think at some point, obviously, they're going to try hard at re-signing Alex DeBrincat, who likely will have the highest cap hit of everybody, and understandably so. When you look at Stützle, you know, I've handicapped him as a breakout candidate. Mm-hmm. People say, hey, this guy broke out last season. But I just think he has another layer, another two levels maybe to get to. You look at the past season, 79 games, 22 goals, 58 points. I think Stutzla has the ability to be a guy who averages at least a point per game. For some reason, and maybe it's unfair to compare him, and maybe it's just because they're both German, but for some reason, I just think about Leon Draisaitl and the way he came into the league and the fact that he was often overlooked and just got better and better and better. And then conversely, you look at Stutzla and his body of work in just 2 years in this league where he was drafted. I seem to be able to draw more comparables than most people when it comes to him and maybe a Draisaitl. I'm not going to say he's going to be that good, but I would not be shocked at all if Tim Stutzla turns into a top 10 player in the NHL. I think he's just scratching the surface because you watch Sens games and there's moments where you're like, my goodness, this guy has more skill than anybody on this roster, more, you know, higher IQ. You can just tell with some players. And I watch Stutzla play and I'm like, this guy can grossly outplay this contract. So I think it was a really good piece of business. And, you know, it's pretty crazy in general. Pierre Dorion went from, you know, one of the seemingly more incompetent GMs in the NHL, at least widely perceived, to one of the, you know, a GM that could be in line for GM of the year given his activity. Mm-hmm. It's just funny how perception can change so quickly, eh?
Yeah, it's pretty wild the way that the idea of Pierre Dorion just being a bumbling fool trying to put something together, that seems to have gone out the window as you look at the body of work from this past offseason. You know, my biggest thought on Stutzla is, and it's with a lot of guys who enter the league at the age of 18, yeah, they've got all the skill in the world, but this is a man's league, and you see it in pro sports across the table, like whether it's, you know, the CFL. The Stampeders have an issue with Jalen Philpott right now where he's their first-round pick from last season, but he can't stay on the field, and the biggest thing for him in the offseason is just get bigger because that's part of the game. And for Tim Stutzla, I think that's part of it as well. This last offseason, if you listen to the interview with 32 Thoughts, he has taken a big kind of undertaking as far as getting his body right for this season and filling out that frame. He's done so to the extent that Jeff Merrick pulled out one of his classic Merrickisms on the latest episode and said he's ripped up like a bad report card. Should write
every
on.
Every player is.
Yeah. Yes, that's a fair point by
it's
Nick.
Tough to play in the NHL.
Yeah, on the old boiler diet. I don't see a lot of those anymore. But Tim Stutzla is one of those guys that I think at 20 years old, there's a lot of room to grow physically. And you mentioned it's the smarts and it's the skills that are already there. And if he can kind of get everything to an even playing field, then this guy's going to be an absolute force for the Senators.
Yeah, and I think you just look at that division in general, too. You start to wonder where the mm-hmm. points are going to come from the Ottawa perspective. You know, I did a podcast yesterday with, you know, Pete Jensen over at NHL Fantasy on Ice, and my proclamation was that the Ottawa Senators would miss the Stanley Cup playoffs. And maybe it's ballsy to say that because of the offseason they've had, but I just look around, I look at that division, I look at that conference, and I wonder where they're getting in. Because how many times, Rosie, have we seen a team get all the allure and all the spotlight in an offseason, and it gets to the regular season, and they're not the real deal Holyfield, mm-hmm. right? So I think it's one thing to say on paper this team has improved. It's another thing to go out there and show it. And I tell you, the pressure is on DJ Smith. You know, you don't wish bad upon anybody, but there is pressure to succeed. There's pressure to make the Stanley Cup playoffs in that market, and they better get off to a good start or they're going to be in trouble, I think.
Well, and the other thing, too, for them is a good start could go a long way, especially because if you are going to get into the playoffs and you want to do it through that division, well, it's going to be tough. You're going to have to, A, beat Toronto every opportunity you get in Tampa and Florida, but you're also going to have to beat Boston every opportunity that you get and try and take advantage of a team that's going to be shorthanded for the first month or so of the season with a whole bunch of their guys undergoing off-season surgeries. So that would be something I look at. You know, the Metropolitan's intriguing. I wonder, like, to me, the East looks like it's going to be a 4-4 split again this year. So I wonder if Boston, do they slip out this year? It doesn't feel like it to me. It feels like the moves they made, they're probably going to find a way to hang around for at least one or two more seasons in the postseason before they have to strip this thing down and make a real big decision on David Pastrnak. But apart from that, you know, I don't think Tampa, Toronto, or Florida are going anywhere.
Hey, anything's possible. Look at that Leafs crease, right? They're putting Kyle Dubas is putting his entire job on the line with Matt Murray and Ilya Samsonov, right? And we know, especially in this market, how vital it is to have competent netminding. The Flames have it in Markstrom. Mm-hmm. Edmonton still thinks they have it now in Jack Campbell, who couldn't hack it in Toronto, but now all of a sudden he hacks it in Edmonton. Like, it's just musical chairs, right? It normally is. And so that is my wonder. I think you look at Florida, I think they're going to be okay. I think the Panthers are sacrificing points in the regular season to be a better playoff team. Again, remains to be seen. I don't know if they checked out last year's postseason, but Matthew Tkachuk really, really struggled offensively. So maybe they're looking for more fights and more scraps against Tampa. But to me, buddy, like, everything runs through the Tampa Bay Lightning. I think Tampa is just so unique in the fact that I don't think they really care if they finish first or where they seed out, because they can beat anybody, and I think they've proved that the last couple of years.
Oh, without a doubt. Like, it was one of those things where, yeah, they're going to kind of hobble, and even this past season, hobble isn't really the right word, but there were instances where you went, they just don't look like they just won two cups. Like, this
they pace
team,
themselves, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. Like you said, like, the regular season, it is what it is. It's 82 games, it's a long way. This isn't a team that's ever really had to fight tooth and nail to get into a wild card spot and then win a Stanley Cup. They've been pretty good throughout the course of the regular season. They've had to do a little cap gymnastics to assist in some of those situations. Fine, whatever. But they're the cream of the crop. You know, Florida showed well, but they've had their fair share of changes. You mentioned the goaltending in Toronto. I think it's a fair question in Florida as well. If you can get another year like that from Bobrovsky, or does it start to be the Spencer Knight show? Or do either of them kind of be able to hold the water? So I don't. There's a lot of questions with that Atlantic Division, really the Eastern Conference in general.
And you look at the remaining RFAs as well. So Kirby Doc, as we mentioned on yesterday's show, signs a new deal, lots of potential there. But now down to 11 remaining RFAs, and obviously the biggest name will be Jason Robertson in Dallas. We talked to Mike Hajka in the last couple of days. I think Rasmus Sandin is a polarizing name to watch in Toronto. They don't have much cap space. Seems to be the same old story every offseason for them. Alex Formanton, Ryan McLeod with Edmonton. Sean Durzi's another name who ran the power play late in the season for the LA Kings. But it just seems like teams are starting to figure out, players as well, Rosie, that it doesn't make much sense to enter the season with a contract stalemate. I just think it puts you behind the eight ball so quickly, and especially the way the pace picks up so quickly in this day and age of the NHL. I think teams are finally starting to learn, and I look at these names and I wonder if anybody gets to a point where they're missing, you know, regular season action this season. Because every year there seems to be a couple names, but it's been dwindling the last couple of years.
Yeah, it was the two big guys in Vancouver that always come to mind for me, and Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson. And I would argue that they missed a little bit of a step. You know, there was a slow start to the season for them. I don't know. Young players, man, I think that it's so important to get into training camp, especially if you're on a team that expects to be, you know, competitive and challenging for something, as all teams should at this point in the year. It's a clean slate. Anything could happen, and then you can adapt as you go. But I just think that when you find yourself in a situation with young players, and honestly, like you mentioned the list, I don't know if anybody on that list is the type of guy that I'm looking at and saying, oh, he's got a real good case here. He should really, you know, hold out. I don't see that. I think in pretty much every single case here, the right thing to do is to go back and play. And play with your team to start and get something done. Even if it means taking a shorter term deal to start.
With you on that front, did you catch any of the Blue Jays game last night?
Yes. It was on in the, we were out at the pub for our draft. There was a grand total of 4 of us out of 14 who showed up.
Oh,
so
wow.
The rest of the 10 of you, brutal.
Did you get them on Skype?
No, Zoom? They just did the little chat in, and I know that several of them were free as well. You know who you are, and you're probably asleep, but you know who you are.
They'll
figure
listen
it
to the
out.
Podcast, don't worry.
Yeah, they'll listen to the podcast, Apple, Google, Spotify, or Amazon. Check it out right now. But yeah, the draft went well. The game was fun to watch. You know, it wasn't the type of game where I'm super dialed in, but every time I looked up, Alec Manoah is still on the bump. My goodness.
Well, that's the play, right? Moral of the story, Alek Manoah should stare down every team the night before he starts against them, right? And unsurprisingly, again, given the importance of these games, there wasn't sort of a pass along from the previous game to last night. Jays take care of business. That's my, you know, the biggest story. Alek Manoah is a horse. We all know that. Eight innings, three hits, a run, five Ks. I just think he was really, really efficient. Like, he didn't have the swing and miss stuff last night, but he had, you know, the swing and soft spots, you know, like I think it was more of like soft contact. That was the story. And pretty impressive that he retired 22 of the past or the final 23 batters that he faced. I just think he has cemented himself as the ace of this team, which is unbelievable considering how relatively young and new he is in the sample size we've seen at the MLB level. And when you're being compared and your numbers and your season ERA are being compared to a guy named Roy Halladay, I mean, that's elite, elite, elite company, not just for the Jays, but in general in Major League Baseball. And I can only fathom what this guy is going to look like in 2 to 3 years from now. Like, I do think the sky is the limit for an Alek Manoah. Again, later on, we have Tim Leeper coming up, who was with the Jays from 14 to 18 as a bench coach. And we'll just get his thoughts. I mean, he's seen a lot of amazing pitchers, but I just love the confidence Alek Manoah and just the stature. Like, you know, this guy goes out, does his thing. You know, they mentioned on the broadcast last night, every start this season, he's gone at least five innings. Just think about that. Like, you got to think there's got to be one day where your stomach's upset and you got to go to the washroom or something. You're not feeling good. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
he just doesn't seem to have that start, which is crazy.
Or one day where you just don't have your stuff. You know, it's the majors. You're hitting these are pretty good batters, and every once in a while there will be a day where maybe you don't sleep. You get, you know, an hour instead of eight, tossing and turning all night, and all of a sudden you go out and you're just throwing meatballs out there and get torn apart. That'll happen. But for him to go five every single game, it's great. You know, knowing the results are usually there as well, and it's a good thing for, you know, at the time, Charlie Montoyo, and even now John Schneider, who can look at it and say, if we're going to him, we know that we probably only need two, maybe three bullpen guys, depending on how things are going to go. And it's probably going to be our best guys. And yesterday he goes eight and he doesn't even throw 100 pitches.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I mean, in the playoffs, you want to get to Bass and Romano at the end of the rotation. Having said that, they cut the game down significantly in the postseason when it comes to pitching, usually, unless it's a guy like Manoah who's just humming along. Like, his pitch count was phenomenal last night, too. Just, again, he was just so efficient. If you cut the game down and get to Bass or Romano, who are really, really lights out, I think you put yourself in a good spot to succeed. It's amazing how quickly things can change, where I think entering the season, you know, there were expectations that Alek Manoah was going to get to be the ace. Well, I can tell you firmly here on, September the 8th, that Alek Manoah is the ace of the Toronto Blue Jays. And, you know, obviously there's still some depth issues, like Mitch White. I mean, he got optioned. Kikuchi. They're really looking and searching for that number five at least. But I can tell you that I would feel very confident at least with Manoah and with Gausman. Obviously, there's still potential there for Barrios. We'll see if we can find it in the last couple starts before the postseason gets underway. But I think they have to feel moderately confident about where they're at from a pitching perspective, more so with Manoah, that you need that big game. You hand the ball to Manoah, and your chances are pretty high, no?
Well, and he's a big, big game type of guy. Like yesterday, not a throwaway tilt in June. That is a final month of the season. What was the quote? I wanted to put him to sleep early. Like, that was the quote from Manoah after the game, and boy, did he ever. He's one of those guys that, you know, you mentioned it off the top. He knew going back to yesterday when that game ended that he was going to go out and throw an absolute gem, the way he was staring that team down, and he delivered. He comes out, and he absolutely delivered, and that's what he's been doing all season long, and it's been a massive boost for this team. For him to be at this point, you know, I remember when he was a first-round pick, and, you know, the MLB first-round pick, you're like, okay, I'll look into the guy a little bit, but we're not going to see him for 5 or 6 years. Boom, he's knocking on the door a couple seasons later, just flying through the ranks, this towering dude who does not care who you are. He's going to go onto that bump, and he's going to stare you down, and he's going to throw his stuff. He's been a lot of fun to watch, so now all you can do is kind of move forward with it. And I do have a question now with the outfield, with, you know, and granted it's only going to be a day or two, but Now with Lourdes Gurriel Jr. hurt, and we don't really know a timeline for that. Teoscar Hernandez on paternity leave until Saturday's game, so there's a question mark for Friday for sure. They've got some guys that I think can fill a hole, but you do wonder about that injury to Lourdes.
Yeah, Raimel Tapia has been on quite the cold stretch and always got a hit in the past couple games. Great to see. And then there's old Whit Merrifield. Like, I will be honest, when they picked up Merrifield, I was fired up, but it was more so because I knew the Whit Merrifield, who was such a prolific name for Kansas City for so many years and was just an absolute stud and could play anywhere, could steal bags. But this guy's been a shell of himself, and I understand he's getting a bit long in the tooth, but last I checked, it's not like he's 45 years old, but he is 12 for 64 as a Blue Jay. Like, and I know he almost hit a bomb last night, but the expectation, the hope is that they could see a couple of big time hits, because it seems like every time he gets up, doesn't matter the situation, nobody on, two people on, it just ground out or pop up. Like, he is really, really, really fighting it offensively to go 12 for 64. And again, in the postseason, everything's under a microscope. You get to a pitch running situation, yeah, you're going to utilize Merrifield, but you need that big hit. And to your point, you know, Gurriel, we'll see what happens there. Teoscar's not in the mix either. So that was a pivotal victory. They're 4.5 up now on Baltimore. You got Texas. It seems like every time they play Texas, Texas plays them well. So I wouldn't sleep on any opponent if I'm the Jays, not to mention they have, what, a 5-game series coming up with the Rays too?
Well, basically, so they've got, I think it's 7 series left. I have it in the morning report, so I'll update you shortly here. But they only have two more series against teams that are below 500. One against Boston, and then a 2-game set against the Phillies are in a wild card spot. It's this matchup against Texas, and then a matchup against the Red Sox. Apart from that, you've got basically playoff opponents the whole way. The Phillies are in a wild card race. The Rays are in a wild card spot. The Yankees are fighting for the top of the division. And then you've got the Orioles, who are nipping at your heels. Granted, not as much of a nip. It's more like you can just kind of hear them gnashing behind you after this most recent series. But nevertheless, they're still hanging around.
Yeah, personally, I think this put Baltimore in a really, really tough spot, without saying. But I was going to ask you, do you think you can walk faster than Alejandro Kirk can run? Like, watching this dude pedal around the bases, like, it's funny, man.
Choo-choo, just chugging away, man. The locomotive.
Reminds me of Benji Molina. Remember Benji Molina?
No, I don't, but, like, they're big dudes. Big dudes, short guy. Low center of gravity, I believe. Like, that dude would just muck in the trenches of an offensive line. He'd be impossible to move off, but...
Well, he's like 5'8", so yeah, I don't know. He'd get steamrooled. But
maybe if he was playing
the key part is that he can catch. His framing's exceptional. His fielding's really good. And he can rake, right? What I was getting at was the fact that he's starting to get hot. You know, not to the smoking level just yet of Bo Bichette, but 3 for 5 last night, 8 for 10 in the past 2 games. That's excellent news, again, because you want everybody going at the right time. And, you know, hopefully the prognosis isn't too bad on Gurriel. And, you know, they get Teoscar back in the mix. And Vladdy, I think, has been fighting it. There's a bit of a hitch in his swing right now. I think he's going to rectify that situation rather quickly, knowing what we know about the player. And I just think the hope is you get to the postseason, assuming they get there, that everybody starts to click at the right time. And then you're really, really feeling good about life, especially, as mentioned, the back end of the bullpen in general has been an excellent story. Then you got Manoa, you start to get that feeling. And I think Jays fans are looking for that feeling right now.
100%. And also, just quickly before we say goodbye, a few thoughts off the text line before we get to the morning report, 960-960. We invite you to take part in the show all the time. Someone wondering, can Nick explain when this twice through the lineup started? When I grew up, like guys like Messina, Randy Johnson, Clemens, Halliday went 7 or 8 easy. And this is something that we've even talked about with John Gibbons, going back to our last chat with him last week.
So it comes down to analytics, you know, and I'm somewhere in the middle, and I would say I'm the same way when it comes to hockey, but it's the BN and NL pretty much in Major League Baseball. That's why I'm excited for the shift, for the most part, to go away next year, because I'm with you. Like, I used to love Roy Halladay and watch him pitch, and it was a guarantee of a CG more times than not, and CG being complete game. Now, you know, the analytics just show that the third time through an order, you know, a pitcher becomes more vulnerable and susceptible to hard contact. Like, it just, again, as a baseball purist, and I'm just 33 and I've played the sport my entire life, I cannot believe how much the sport has changed from when I started playing as a little leaguer to now when I'm 33. And granted, everything evolves and changes and we look at other sports, but it's just become a shadow of itself where it's all about computers, it's all about numbers, and it's got nothing to do with the actual players on the field, sadly.
Yeah, but yeah, well, all the numbers and the crunch, it's that damn money ball, man. Ruined
pretty
everything.
Much, pretty much, and they never won, right? So good for them.
That's a good point. They were a team that fielded a major league squad, but they did never win. That's true. 960-960. We also had a text asking, how did the former 960 staff NFL draft go? How's your team? Did anybody make a bad pick? And I'm only going to take 30 seconds here. I'll tell you this. The most questionable pick was definitely Bo Levi Mitchell going to Cooper Kupp with the second overall selection, leaving Derrick Henry, Austin Eckler, and Christian McCaffrey on the board after our old pal Boomer took Jonathan Taylor with the first overall pick. Also, Derek Wills with an interesting tactic going running back, quarterback, tight end in the first three rounds to end up with Najee Harris, Josh Allen, and Kyle Pitts. In a 14-team league, you just don't usually see guys getting the tight end and the quarterback that early because there is such a high demand for position players, and for him to choose to kind of get the best quarterback and one of the best tight ends overall, I thought that was intriguing. But then again, he didn't end up with the tight end and quarterback tandem that I did, TJ Hawkinson and Kirk Cousins, when I waited until round 7 and 8. So there's just a smidgen on the fantasy draft. But listen, we'll get into it all season long. And we got another one with all the new people here at the station, too. So I'm sure we'll discuss plenty of that as the year goes on. Our fake football, because who doesn't love to hear about that, right?
Exactly. I'm going to have to put some more money in my account, start betting on some football. You know, I'm not the biggest football guy, but I like to splash around a couple bucks. I'll just ask my buddies what they think and away with it, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And someone asking if Rhett drafted two kickers, which does happen a lot of times.
It's a good strategy.
Where did his team go here? Where is he? Simply the breast. Stephon Diggs was his first pick. Shocking. It looks like he only has a single kicker this year. Yep, just one kicker. He did take the Buffalo defense with the 121st and overall pick. So he was the first one to take
everybody
a defense.
Is all about those Buffalo Bills.
Well, he's
like,
a,
I think it's,
he's a diehard, so he got four of them.
It's a kiss of death, man. It has the feel of the Jays. Remember going into this season, lockout ended, the Jays are winning the World Series. They're going to win one in the next couple years, and well, it's been a struggle to even get to the postseason, and the Yankees have owned the division, and Tampa's coming, so just be careful what you wish for, and be careful what you bet on.
You know, it's intriguing that we brought up Moneyball, because following Rhett's fantasy team is a lot like Moneyball. You could make a movie out of this season as a whole, but in the end, yeah, he's not going to win. He's not going to win.
You never know.
You get an idea at this point, but yeah, we wish him luck. Not that much luck, because I play him in week one.
Thanks for your donation, right? What's the
this what's the one, buy-in? Oh, we bumped it up this year.
Okay.
Everyone left the station. All of a sudden, they got all this money. 150 bone entry
okay.
this year, which is...
So there's some stake?
Well higher than what we've ever done. So very excited for that. All right. Take a break. Morning Report's next. We basically talked about plenty of stuff that's going to be in the Morning Report, but we got all the details and a jam-packed show. Ian Mendez talking the Senators and the recent sign of Tim Stützle. Ian from The Athletic. That'll be just after 7 o'clock. Tim Leeper, the former first base coach of the Toronto Blue Jays, going to talk a little bit baseball coming up at 7:30. And then at 8, we're going all NFL. Cabbie Richards from Sportsnet going to join us, and Steve Tasker, who covers the Bills, also going to join us, all before what you want to talk about. Sports at 960 The Fan. It's hour one of the show. This is where we do the Morning Report every single day, and it's brought to you by Motorworks. Exceeding all expectations, BMW repairs and service in a state-of-the-art facility where they'll meet and beat all competitors' quotes on 51st Ave and 3rd Street Southeast. I'm Matt Rose.
Marty Rose.
I'm Matt Rose. Listen, Nick, I told you yesterday it wasn't going to happen often. We won't have days like yesterday where there isn't hockey news to talk about. And today, That's true. We've got hockey news to talk about. We'll get to the Jays. We'll get to the start of the NFL season, all that stuff in a second. But yesterday, we did have a hockey signing.
Pierre Dorion makes hockey decisions.
Pierre Dorion and the Ottawa Senators coming to terms on a long-term contract extension with 2020 third overall pick Tim Stützle. An 8-year extension worth $66.8 million, 8.35 on the AAV. It'll kick in after he plays this final year at less than $1 million on his entry-level contract. Like I said, kicks in after the ELC is over. 12 goals and 29 points in 53 games his rookie year. Then he had 22 goals and 59 points in 79 games last season. The plus-minus wasn't great, but the team wasn't great either. He's going to be in the top six, a top six that added Giroux and DeBrincat, with an already potent top line of Norris, Tkachuk, and Batherson. I like the signing for the Senators. They've got their core. They've got their core set for basically the next 5 or 6 years.
Was that a new bumper, by the way?
The new one off the
on
top.
On the Rose Report?
Yeah, it was a little different just because the other one has the baseball music built into it, and this one has the hockey music built into it. So we're switching it up, moving out of the baseball openers on the Morning Report and into the hockey openers on the Morning Report. So, yeah, it might have a little bit of a different intro.
Adapting on the fly. I like that, man. I like that. So the comparables on this contract, Brady Tkachuk, Andrei Svechnikov. I like the deal significantly. You just mentioned the numbers coming off a season where he had 58 points, 79 games. I think Stützle has the ability to be a point-per-game player at the very least, and that's why I think down the road this contract will look favorably for the Ottawa Senators. So nice piece of business. It's weird to see Ottawa as a cap team, isn't it?
Yeah, it's strange, but I'm here for it. I like when more teams are cap teams. It's good for the league. That's what I'll say. Also, we chatted about this during the show on Wednesday as it broke quite early, but Kirby Dach also signed with the Canadiens 4 years, $13.45 million. So 3.36 and change on the AAV for the 21-year-old center, who was also, strangely enough, a third overall pick. Habs general manager Kent Hughes did speak to the media after the signing, and I wanted to get this out for the Flames fan, for the Flames fans. He was asked about the timeline for former Flame Sean Monahan, who looks to return to action sooner rather than later.
I spoke to Sean today, and he's going to skate with the group tomorrow. He feels great. You know, I think when he had his first hip surgery, it was supposed to be 6 to 7 months, and he came back 4 months, and I think he struggled with that. You know, forcing the recovery and then ending up making it a prolonged recovery. So he feels great, but, you know, I was very clear with him. Like, we didn't trade for you to play opening night against Toronto. If it's a week later, if it's 2 weeks later, that's fine. It sounds like he feels really good. If it's not opening night, I sense that it's pretty close.
So you like to hear that, just for Sean Monahan's sake, because I think that a lot of people in this city are hoping for a nice bounce back for him. And listen, we had talked about Kirby Dach and what he can do for that team being kind of a second-line center, and then you've got Christian Dvorak and you've got Paul Byron. But Sean Monahan is another interesting little wrinkle in there as far as center depth.
Yeah, certainly, and I don't know what the rush is, and certainly they're not going to tell us much, but I think the goal here is to butter this guy up, beef him up, and then trade him at the deadline, right, for an asset. You hope Monahan has a pretty decent season and you can trade him with somebody who needs a center. I think that would have to be the goal. If I'm Kent Hughes.
Yeah, you'd have to look at it at least. Now, listen, you don't have Carey Price. The blue line is not what it used to be, but there's some decent veteran players on this team that are either going to play well or have value for you at the deadline, you would have to hope. But you do like to hear that Sean Monahan could be ready for the start of the season, or at least the near the start of the season. We'll shift to the Toronto Blue Jays, who are closing out their set with the Baltimore Orioles. We had Alek Manoah on the bump for this one. A big matchup playoff-wise, and a big matchup after these two teams jawed back and forth on the diamond and in the media the day before. Manoah was seen just taking it all in Wednesday as the Orioles celebrated their victory. So what would have been in store for Baltimore in the finale? Prior to the game, the Jays did make a couple of roster moves. They recalled catcher Gabby Moreno and righty Zach Pop while optioning Mitch White to AAA after another disappointing performance the day prior. They recalled Moreno with Teoscar Hernandez hitting the paternity list. He's expected to rejoin the team Saturday when they play the Rangers down in Texas. But the first run in yesterday's contest came in the first inning. Not a great start for the Jays' bats, but Alek Manoah quickly nabbed two outs. He had two strikes on Santander trying to end the inning when the outfielder would strike a double to get on base that brought the pesky very pesky Ryan Mountcastle to the dish.
Book manager's not expecting any spillover. Here's a ground ball, inside out, slip past the reach of Guerrero up the right field line. Getting into the corner, Tapia's a long right run to dig this one out. They're going to try to score Santander. Here's the relay throw, and it's not in time. Ryan Mountcastle slips one up the right field line, running on contact with two outs. Santander comes in to score. It's 1-0 Baltimore on an RBI triple from Ryan Mountcastle.
And that was one watching that I was still at home for this part of the game. As soon as that got under Vladdy's glove, it was like, oh no, that's trouble.
Yeah, that was belted down the line. But I think that's the key with when you're facing horses like Alek Manoah is you have to get them as soon as you can because these guys seem to settle in, and that's exactly what happened in this game.
Yeah, he would escape the inning having allowed just the one run, but then the Jays' bats woke up very quickly. It was bases loaded for Lourdes Gurriel Jr. after Kirk singled, Chapman walked, and then Tapia also singled.
1-2. Ground ball up the middle of the diamond. Sucked up by Mateo. Underhand feed to Odor for one. Throw to first. Not in time. Gurriel tumbles through the first base bag. He reaches down and he's holding his left knee. Kirk comes in to score to tie the game. Tapia slides into second on the fielder's choice. He's out. But Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is now the biggest moment of concern in this ballgame for the Blue Jays. Writhing in pain.
Now, you get the run there, which is great, but Lourdes Gurriel Jr. knocks in a run, but hurts himself in the process, knocks himself out of the game. It was the left leg while he was just trying to run through the base. As you heard Ben say, he looked like he was grabbing his knee, kind of looked like he was grabbing the back of the quad, the hamstring of that left leg as well. Didn't get much of an update after the game, but that's going to be interesting to see how they adapt because Whit Merrifield came in, replaced him in the outfield. That was fine. Jays could only get that one run across, though. Didn't need a ton of offense with the way Alek Manoah was pitching from the start of the second, really to the bottom of the sixth. 13 straight batters that he sat down. That was until Adley Rutschman, the young stud catcher for the Orioles, hit a double. Got a little help from the infield along the way, did Manoah. How about this nifty little play in the bottom of the third?
Swing on the first pitch. Top ball over towards Guerrero. Flips it to Manoah to get the out. What a play by Vladimir Guerrero Jr. over at first base. Alek Manoah loves it. They get the out on Adley Rutschman.
And it was a behind-the-back flip pass from Guerrero there to Manoah. Looked quite nice. It reminded me of the Bartolo Colon play from a few years back.
Oh, yeah, it does. And as a first baseman growing up, I, you know, really, really appreciate a play like that. More so to lead Manoah to the bag. That's extremely difficult to do in real time. And Vladdy has really taken to that position really, really quickly. Let's not forget, he came into the majors as a three-bagger.
Yeah, exactly. And yes, there was the instance early on where the ball snuck by him underneath his glove. But yeah, then you get a play like that, and also he absolutely mashes the ball. So Vladdy helped the Jays take the lead in the fifth inning. Helped out Alec in so many different ways as well. How about this in the fifth?
Here's Vladdy. First pitch, a broken bat roller out to the second baseman. Odor with a bobble now has one play. That's to go to first as Espinal comes in to score. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. will pick up the RBI on the 4-3 bounce out. Pitch by Kramer. Swinging a broken bat looper behind third base. In for a base hit. Bradley speeds around third. He'll come in to score. Bo wants third base. He tiptoes into the bag in front of the throw. He's in there safely on an RBI base hit from Alejandro Kirk. Equaled that in doubles and also had three triples. Here's a throw that goes down to first base out of the reach of Mountcastle. Eludes the first baseman on the back pick. Bo trots across the plate. He will score. That didn't pan out at all. A throwing error on Rutschman allows one run to score. And it's a 4-1 Blue Jay lead.
So the Jays jump out to a three-run lead in the fifth inning. And as mentioned, 13 straight retired for Manoah from the bottom of the second to the bottom of the sixth before Rutschman doubled. But it would amount to nothing. He would knock down the next seven batters, he being Manoah, for the Orioles, leaving the game after eight efficient and really surgical innings. Only one earned run against. That came back in the first. Three hits, one walk, five strikeouts along the way. And Manoah did it all in just 95 pitches. In came Jordan Romano to secure the dub.
Romano again in the 1-2. Swing and a miss. He struck him out. A fastball in the outside corner. Check swing by Mountcastle. He's officially rung up to finish the ball game. A 1-2-3 ninth inning save for Jordan Romano, his 31st of the season.
Nice save, Romano.
Off day for the Jays now after the 4-1 win and the series victory over the Orioles. Another nice save for Romano. Now it's a travel day. They'll head down They'll head down to Texas to battle the Rangers. Easy enough for
Nailed
me to
it.
Say. Yeah.
Nailed it.
Mm. Like they did in that series. Great job. Except for maybe the one game. But overall, I think you got to be happy taking 3 of 4 from the O's here.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're feeling great about life. And certainly it's been Jekyll and Hyde the last month or pretty much the entire season for this Jays team. But you just got to continue to build momentum and not look past Texas because you have Tampa after that.
8 more series left to play. A couple of them with Baltimore, a couple of them with Tampa, one with New York, one with Boston, this against the Rangers, and a mini set with the Phillies. You're battling Baltimore for a playoff spot. Tampa and New York are firmly in a playoff position. The Phillies are in a wild card spot in the NL. The only sub-500 teams left on the schedule are Texas and Boston, so you can't lose any ground here. Good job last weekend doing that against the Pirates. Do that again. Taking a look at the other teams in the AL wildcard race, Rays and Sox down at Tropicana Field, closing out their series. Tampa looking for the sweep. Boston, however, did make this one a little bit difficult to secure. Pretty solid outing from the Canadian Nick Pivetta. He went 5 innings, but it was in that 5th inning the Rays would get the only run that they needed.
Years, 3-2 now, and a little tap, and that ball hit directly toward the second base umpire, and the Rays are going to get a run. By the time Hernandez could get over there, there was no place to go, and the Rays are on the board.
Walls with the RBI there. Yonny Chirinos was solid out of the pen in his return to the majors. Hasn't pitched since August of 2020, dealing with setbacks from Tommy John surgery. Struck out 4 over 3, 9 strikeouts total from the Rays pitching staff. They win 1-0. They're off today and begin a weekend set in the Bronx on Friday. The Mariners also on quite a clip of late, looking for the series victory yesterday afternoon against the Chicago White Sox. Skip ahead to the 6th. Things didn't go so well for the Mariners. Trade deadline acquisition, Luis Castillo runs into some trouble. 4-2 entering the top of the 6th by 1-1. The White Sox chipped away until they left the inning, leading the game 6-4. Next inning, Eugenio Suarez, already on hit 1,000 of his MLB career, homers for the second time of the game, tying the game at 6. That's good news for the Mariners. So the winning run came later in the game, bottom of the 8th. Gavin Sheets at the dish.
2-2. Loop to shortstop, and this will be the 7th run.
This is such a good at-bat by Gavin Sheets. Yes, he might have been the slowest ball he's hit in play all year, but it worked out perfectly.
That's all you needed. Second RBI of the game for Sheets ended up in an out, but that was the winning run. The Sox did tack on a couple more to win it 9-6. Seattle plays the Braves this weekend. They're off today. So let's look at the standings. Tampa Bay, they are in the first wild card spot. They are a game up on Seattle. Seattle's in the second wild card spot. They are a half game up on Toronto. So doing the math, Tampa is a game and a half up on Toronto. The Orioles, after the most recent series with the Blue Jays, 4.5 games back of a playoff spot. And should also mention, the Twins and White Sox have fallen back of the wild card. They're 7.5 games out, but they're also both just 2 games back of Cleveland for the division lead in the AL Central. So we'll see how they go moving forward. Oh my goodness, I'm so excited, Nick. What do we have here?
Uh-oh, new music.
Yeah, we haven't heard. You haven't heard this one. This is a new one. The start of a brand spanking new NFL season. Listen, the offseason's been fun. Tom Brady's back. Aaron Rodgers is still with the Pack. Danger Russ went to Mile High City. Baker's now in Carolina. Tyreek Hill and Devontae Adams, two of the most productive receivers of the past decade, both found new offseason homes. We've got a whole new draft class entering the league and a bunch of coaching changes to set up a very interesting season. And it all begins tonight. We've got the Buffalo Bills.
Let's go, Buffalo.
Let's go, Buffalo.
Let's go, Buffalo.
Let's go, Buffalo.
They're on the road. They're going to be taking on the LA Rams.
Oh,
So a couple of fight songs there from the Bills and the Rams. 6:15. That's when that one's going to start. I like the Bills song more, frankly. Just me.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think there's a bit more pizzazz to it. I'm with you.
The Rams seems very commercial, you know?
Yes. Yeah. With I know you on that front.
And I know the Bills is just a rip of a popular song, but I just like it more. Listen, the Rams are looking to defend their title. They got some new faces. Former Seahawks linebacker Bobby Wagner's there. Former Bears receiver Allen Robinson to spell off Cooper Kupp, who's fresh off a monster new deal this offseason. How will A-Rob and Kupp attack the Bills' defense that has already lost all-star corner Tre'Davious White to a knee injury? Von Miller was also crossed the floor, left the Rams. He's now a member of the Bills. He'll face his former team tonight. His former team, also the Vegas underdog for the first time in a long time. The Bills are favored by 2.5 points, and the total is set at 52.
You are a degenerate!
It's that time of year where it's not being a degenerate to bet on football on a Thursday evening.
It's an occupation.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll go with that. Away from the game, Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson told reporters that the deadline for him to get a contract extension in place with the Ravens is Friday. According to reports, he'd still be willing to play on the final year of his deal, paying him $25 million. Looking for that Deshaun Watson money, though. 5 years, $230 million guaranteed. Jackson is his own agent as well, an interesting wrinkle, but also makes the deadline for talks with the team not a surprise as he starts to focus on the season. From the CFL.
That octopus certainly is all about business. He takes care of business, and he's a good leader for our team.
That's a good octopus. The Stamps held a brief session on Wednesday. They prepare for a Saturday tilt with the Edmonton Elks. Injury report came later. Can say Natrell Jamerson did not practice. Brandon Dozier was a full participant. The Stampeders have a closed practice today. Then they'll travel Friday to Edmonton for their Saturday game at Commonwealth against the Elks. We'll have a Stampeders report coming up for you in Sportsnet today. That'll be between 3 and 4 o'clock later on the station. At the U.S. Open, quarterfinals continued on Wednesday. On the men's side, the early match had 9th-seeded Russian Andrei Rublev facing American Francis Tiafoe, the 22nd seed. The crowd was at Tiafoe's back. He was able to win both the first sets in tiebreaker fashion before finishing off his higher-seeded opponent 6-4 for a straight sets win and a trip to the semis. He'll now face the third-seeded Carlos Alcaraz García of Spain after García won the late match in 5 sets, including 2 tiebreakers. The semifinals for the men are going on Friday. Tiafoe and Alcaraz García in one match, and 5th-seeded Norwegian Casper Ruud will face the 27th-seeded Russian in the other. Then on the women's side, Aryna Sabalenka advanced. She defeated Karolina Pliskova of Czechia in straight sets, gave way to an evening match between American 8th-seed Jessica Pegula and the 1-seed Iga Swiatek of Poland. Pegula would fall in front of the home crowd, losing in straight sets. Semifinals will go later on today. And another tournament for the LPGA calendar kicks off today, the Kroger Queen City Championship at the Kenwood Country Club in beautiful Cincinnati, Ohio. 4 Canadians in the field, Brooke Henderson, Alina Sharp, Matty Zarek, and Madame LeBlanc. That starts today. That'll wrap up on Sunday. And that is going
to
do it.
And good night and good luck to you, sir.
That's the Morning Report, and it's brought to you by Motorworks. Exceeding all expectations, BMW repairs and service in a state-of-the-art facility where they'll meet and beat all competitors. Quotes 51st Ave and 3rd Street, Southeast. Decent little slate of sports that we got today, hey, Nick?
Yeah, I was going to say when you said Jessica Pegula's name, I thought you were going to rip the Let's Go Buffalo again. Of course, that's the daughter of the Pegulas.
Let's go Buffalo!
There you go. Boom.
I imagined, I was like, maybe she is, but probably not. That would be very unlikely.
I wonder what it was like, that upbringing, having all that money to just practice tennis. That's every time I see her, I'm like, they have so much money. She probably practiced 8 hours a day anywhere she wanted. Wimbledon, fly her out here or there, but it's an amazing story to see her there.
Have you heard the story for Francis Tiafoe before?
No.
Just real quick. He's... so his family moved to the U.S. His father helped build a tennis center and did such a good job that they hired him to be a custodian. and he was working days and nights there. So they gave him an office that also had beds in it, and that's where Francis and his brother and his mother and his father ended up staying. They basically lived at the tennis center. So they don't come from a lot of money, just from a lot of hard work and kind of being around tennis. And for him to be now in the semifinals, awesome to see and great to see the crowd behind him. And he's talked plenty about Serena Williams and kind of the idol that she presented, being a person of color in a position that she was for so long. So you really do love what we're seeing for Tiafoe, and hopefully he can get some work done Friday in the semifinals as well. We'll take a quick break, though. Around the corner, we got to get to Ian Mendez. We're going to talk a little bit of Ottawa Senators. They're one of the more intriguing teams after this offseason, where they have added a ton and look to take another big step in the right direction in that Atlantic division. We'll talk to Ian around the corner. You're listening to The Big Show in the Morning on Sportsnet 960 The Fan.